Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's Green Thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants, indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. See homedepot.com/delivery for details.
Hey, listener, are you happy with your current chicken wings? Do you wish you had something a little saucier? If you answered yes, then it might be time for you to break up with your old chicken wings and get a new honey. Lemon pepper wing from Popeyes. Share the wings with your friends so they can see it's time to move on, too. Head to Popeyes and get 6-piece honey lemon pepper wings for $5.99. At participating U.S. restaurants, price may vary.
Welcome to the Pro Basketball Talk podcast. I'm Dan Feldman. I'm here with Mike Prada. And Mike, I want to thank you for coming on. I want to start with where I left off on the last podcast with Kurt Heelan, which was being utterly confused about what to do with Western Conference Finals MVP. I believe the NBA is missing a huge opportunity to name MVPs of playoff series. Just to do it for the NBA Finals is cutting it so short. We have players of the week during the regular season. We have two players of the week during the regular season. So I'm trying to reverse this on my own this year, publishing an MVP for every playoff series. Western Conference Finals MVP. I think you could pick about four Suns or one Clipper. Who do you think makes most sense for that?
Well, that's a question I didn't expect to start this thing off. Just so we need more awards to argue about.
But this is a good award, right? Like, who cares about player of the week in the regular season? Like, if you were the best player for a playoff series, especially this deep in the playoffs, but any playoff series, isn't that a good award, a meaningful award that we should care about?
Yeah, okay, I hear you. It's definitely better than some of the awards you already have. Who should be the MVP? I mean, I feel like the narrative choice would have been Chris Paul, but Chris Paul had rough game, obviously missed the first two games and really only had one good game in the series. So I feel like that's tough to do. Why not DeAndre Ayton? That would be my first instinct.
Yeah. I mean, he was probably the best son for maybe one game, any other son. He was probably the most consistent player throughout the series for the Suns. Devin Booker, obviously so good at the beginning and then fall off. You could go Paul George too.
Yeah.
Let's go to Chris. Talk about Chris Paul for a second, though. He had one good game. You're right. It was also the last game. What is your confidence level now for him to be playing at that high level in the finals? I feel a little better that it was the last game, but still a little concerned how he looked through the other games once he came back.
I mean, let me put it this way: pretend like he doesn't have the COVID protocols. I think it's pretty clear that the shoulder is healthy. Let's say that like he goes through these playoffs unscathed, and this is the matchup. Like, does that change how you feel about him?
Well, I mean, he did have the protocols, right?
I know what you're saying, but the protocols are over. I guess like what I'm saying is that the protocols seem like they're in the rear view, right? So like if you stripped away all the other stuff, like let's you just talk about his game versus this matchup. Like, would this be a good or bad matchup for him? And I think the answer is interesting, and it depends on sort of what I think is one of the more interesting questions of this series based on the regular season matchups, which is how much is Brook Lopez going to be on the floor? If he's playing most of the time, the number one question, of course, is when Giannis is coming back, if he's coming back, all that stuff. Let's assume that he's back pretty early and he's playing. If you're Milwaukee, Lopez, if you play Lopez, one of the things that we've seen from Chris Paul throughout the playoffs really is that when you play a big guy and you play a drop coverage, or you play a softer coverage, he's normally picking that apart. He did it really well with Nikola Jokic in the second round in particular. He had, I think, when he played well in the fourth quarter of the game six, a lot of it was like sort of versus this type of softer coverage. When he played worse, I think, is when the Clippers were switching a little bit more, keeping him in the mud. Milwaukee can kind of do either now. They can play Brook Lopez and play their traditional coverages, or now they can switch off, or as we saw at the end of the Hawks series, they can play Brook Lopez and still switch everything. So a lot of it depends on what the coverage is. I feel like if Chris Paul, it depends a lot more on sort of what Milwaukee shows rather than the health status of Chris Paul. I think at this point, we kind of have to assume that Paul is healthy enough to perform. You know, I don't think that his, I think his struggle in game three was like post-COVID protocol, but the rest of the series, I think that's a tricky matchup, the Clippers, for him, you know, with the way that they're able to switch. The Clippers are a very unique team, which I know is a double, what do they call it? Like a double combination, very unique, but the Clippers are a unique team. The Bucks are very different from them. Interestingly, in the regular season, I think Chris had two very good games against Milwaukee. I know the second one, he was quite good. So I think, yeah, I mean, I don't see why he can't play at his normal level. To me, I'm like sort of stripping away some of the injury stuff and just trying to consider the matchup. You know, maybe that's a little naive, but certainly as far as injury concerns in this series, he's not the number one for these two teams. I think the number one is obviously Giannis.
For sure. I mean, well, what did you see in those conference finals? Because I had a hard time understanding why Chris Paul was so lousy when he came back, other than, hey, maybe this is Russ. Like, you're saying maybe only one game of Russ. What before, you know, he was so good in the last game. Did you see something change for him against the Clippers, or what they could do against him? Where, you know, like you said, he wasn't very good until that last game, even beyond once he came back.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if it was rust or if it was he's so close to the promised land and he has obviously a propensity to try to grind everything out. But the Clippers series was a series where the Suns needed to win on tempo and speed. You know, the Clippers, paradoxically, the Clippers wanted to play slower. You know, they wanted the game to be five out, controlled, shooting threes, and not letting the Suns sort of break away from them. And they wanted, the Clippers were kind of the team that, you know, at a talent disadvantage, they wanted to grind it out. And when Chris played into their hands, whether it was due to fatigue or due to just his like sort of natural proclivity to slow the ball, the game down, I think the Clippers had an advantage. In game six, you saw it mostly in the second half, and I think it was a team-wide thing, but it reflected in Chris Paul's numbers. The Suns finally were just playing more free like they had to get to that point. I think they reached a point, and I credit Ty Lue for this. I credit the way that they've kind of – they cleverly defended Chris, the way they sort of put together a two-way front that was kind of a very well tempo controlled. They got back well in transition. They grinded it out on offense, kind of picking the matchup. All of that, I think, harmed Chris in a half court game, particularly also when they played small and Zubac went back to the bench. In game six, certainly coming out of the second half, the Suns were much more decisive with their running. Chris was much more willing to push the ball and get into stuff quickly. And that's why he, I think, ultimately succeeded. It was a half-court game by the end, but it became a full-court game in that third quarter. That, to me, is sort of the real question, because the Suns, I think, have a tendency against really good teams to get stuck in mud, but they break that by playing with pace and playing with tempo. And that is really where Chris Paul, sometimes he's really good at that, and then there's sort of the 10% of the time where he still acts like the old Chris Paul, and he kind of tries to grind that game out. So I think to me that's sort of where his effectiveness starts to come from, because he was playing in such a grinding level. Campaign was such a key player for the Suns in that Clippers series. This series with Milwaukee is going to be just such an interesting tempo battle, because both of these teams are kind of grimy half-court teams that love to run off misses. So it's going to be really interesting to see who controls that tempo. And in a lot of ways, that's the key for Chris Paul, is if he's pushing off makes, if they're forcing misses, if he's pushing off misses, if he's willing to pitch the ball ahead, if he's getting into stuff quickly, then I think he can be really effective. If he's not, I think he will be ineffective.
You mentioned the Bucks defense, and I think that's going to be so important because – yeah, they often would run a drop with Brook Lopez. They can switch. They show they can even switch with Brook Lopez. But when they were switching with Brook Lopez, that was with you know either Trae Young not there or a slowed Trae Young. I think it's going to be a different challenge against Chris Paul, against Devin Booker. What are you expecting from the Bucks' defensive strategy in this series?
Going to be really interesting. It's definitely a different setup in that I think that switching strategy worked for about a game and a half against Atlanta. And then even though Atlanta lost game six, I thought they were starting to figure out, like, kind of, hey, we can move this quicker. We can pull Trey Brook Lopez out, swing the ball to the other side, and then he's not there. And I think that if they were more disciplined, they would have been able to beat it. Now, Phoenix is an interesting – this is going to be an interesting challenge because on the one hand, Phoenix is very good with their spacing, with their unselfishness, with – all the stuff they do to set up into the plays. So in theory, they should be a harder team to switch against. On the other hand, they do have periods where, especially if you hit first on their off ball motion. I talked about this in the Clippers series. One of the biggest reasons I think Devin Booker struggled is that Pat Beverly was all over him at the beginning of the plays. They wouldn't just let him sort of curl in comfortably and fast into his actions. And so Booker was often pulling the ball back or having to take extra steps. It sort of ruined the flow of Phoenix's offense. When that happens, the Suns do get into a lot of trouble against switching defenses. And there is going to be periods where it's a lot of dribble, 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 a lot of stagnation, because ultimately they only have really two entry points on the perimeter, three if when Campaign's playing well, but generally only two at once. And Booker and Paul, and both of those guys, I think, are more effective when they're kind of slightly moving than when they are stopped, stand still. Even Booker, I think his strength is catching the ball on the move and then dictating tempo from there. So I think it's going to be really interesting, I think, to see how Coach Bud deploys these coverages, because it is going to require a mixture. I don't think he can show his hand too quickly. And I do think that if Giannis's health matters a lot, because they got away with Bobby Portis playing a switching scheme against Atlanta. I think that particularly with all the stuff Phoenix does off the ball better than Atlanta, that will not work in this series. So how healthy is Giannis to execute this? But I suspect that by the end of this series, we will see mostly a switching style from Milwaukee. And I would not be surprised to see Brook Lopez not play as often. If you look at the regular season games, in the first game, no Jrue Holiday for the record, but still, that end of that game was sort of an exercise in how do we keep Brook Lopez out of the main action at the end of that game. It was like this fun little chess match where if you just watch away from the ball, like Lopez is basically trying to guard like six different players to make sure he's not on the ball. In the second game, Milwaukee went small, sat Brook Lopez at the end of the game, played PJ Tucker, and they didn't win that game, but it helped them come back. I think that was more effective for them against Phoenix than playing Brook Lopez. So I do think by the end of this series, you are going to see a lot more of that. And I think the degree to which it works will depend a lot on what happens away from the ball rather than what happens on the ball, because Phoenix basically can get stagnant. But I do think by the end of that series, you're going to see a lot more of that. I just don't know if you're going to start with that because, A, we know Coach Bud likes to hold his cards in reserve, so to speak, plus Giannis's injury. Plus, like, I don't know if you want to show Phoenix your top look right away. You know, they're very good at making in-game and next-game adjustments. But I do think that maybe not necessarily the rotations, but I wouldn't be surprised if by like game three or four, like it's just, but the Bucks are just going to be switching everything.
Well, that's why I think this is such an interesting matchup in terms of how the league is headed. The Bucks have an excellent defense overall, how they like to play, you know, with Brook Lopez in their dropping. It works against almost all opponents, but sometimes I think, oh no, you're going to run into somebody in the playoffs, and it's probably the Suns. It might have even been the Hawks when Trae Young was healthy.
What about Brooklyn?
Oh, for sure. You're going to run into teams where it doesn't work, and then there's trouble there. And I don't know if there's a great solution for the Bucks because they're capable of switching. They're not that good at it, though. Maybe a little better.
They're certainly a lot better than they used to be.
Right. But not good. And I mean, the Suns are a really good team. We're talking about some narrow margin for error here. I'm just wondering, like, to a certain degree, if the Bucks, if the way they like to play with their base set defensively is just fatally flawed, that you're wasting too much time doing it because you're going to run into a matchup where it just really doesn't work.
This was what the story of the season was for Milwaukee in a lot of ways, though, right? This was a known problem from the past couple postseasons. This is how they fell short. And they sacrificed a lot of wins this year in order to try a lot of this stuff out, to try to try out some switching, try out some different lineups and different matchups to kind of experiment a little bit. And they've done it on offense too, with the dunker spot stuff, with putting a guard there and all that. This is what they've spent all year preparing for this moment where it's like, okay, our base defense doesn't necessarily work. How do we adapt? And though I think Coach Bud has this reputation for being slow to adjustments that is somewhat deserved, I think they have adapted a little better than people would have expected. I mean, they definitely adapted against Atlanta. They had a lot of great defensive moments against Brooklyn, playing both a more traditional defense and having Brook a little bit higher in the drop and switching. They were able to sort of navigate some of that. So I'm actually curious to hear, like, when you say they're not good at switching, like, what are they not good at switching?
Well, I see it enough times where there's a miscommunication on the switch, because you're absolutely right. They've done it way more this year. They're better at it, but they still seem uncomfortable with it at times. The other thing I'd say is, you know, Brook Lopez, he is one of your best players, one of your best defenders for sure. When you have him out there, when you have him switching, you're not putting him in a position of strength. When he gets pulled out on the perimeter, at times in certain matchups, he's done a better job. He can hold his own. But where he's a real difference maker is when you can get him in the paint protecting the rim. And so if you're switching, you're just getting out of your strengths.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, of course you are. And that's sort of what they've worked on. Now, I agree. I think where they struggle sometimes is like not necessarily coordinating the first switch, but sort of the backside stuff, you know, like, or recovering to their man. And I think it certainly happens with certain players in. Like, if you look at it, again, Bobby Portis was a really effective player against Atlanta. I would worry about him on the backside in this series because of all the stuff the Suns do really well with their cutting and their spacing. That may be a problem. Now, with Brook Lopez and switching, obviously Chris Paul is like a master in the mid-range, a master manipulator against bigs. But the Suns do not have a player that traditionally stretches out a player like Brook Lopez, which is that sort of deadly pull-up three-point threat, right? They don't have a Kevin Durant. They don't have a Trae Young even. And I know Trae was limited and is, I think, slightly overrated as a long shooter. He makes them and he takes them, but he's much better getting downhill. The Suns don't have that player. Devin Booker isn't really that player. He sometimes can be in rare spots, and I think he should be more that player. But Devin Booker isn't necessarily like in Kevin Durant in Game 5 of that Nets series, where he's just running pick and roll from half court and doing whatever he wants. The Suns don't have that kind of player. Lopez can kind of hang back, still come out, but he doesn't have to jump out beyond the 3-point line in this matchup. He may have to move a lot before the play and then have to kind of cover because of Phoenix's movement. But he doesn't have, there's not a series where there's not a player that really stretches him in space, you know? So of all the matchups you could have in this finals, I think there are worse ones for him than this. Now, that being said, I agree that the Suns pick and roll game is really strong, but if you're switching a lot of the stuff on the backside early with the Suns, you know, so much of what the Suns do is they kind of, the way they set up their pick and rolls and the timing of their screens and that Spain action that they like to run, which is, you know, for those who don't know, is that staggered pick and roll at the top of it from the middle, where there's like one screen and then a back screen at the bottom. And they time all that well, and the dribble handoffs into the screens. You might be able to disrupt some of that by switching effectively there. Now, I understand what you're saying. The Bucks are not the best at that. They're certainly not as good as the Clippers, and that may be a problem. But I don't think that the Bucks are this super inflexible team anymore like they were in the past. They have better personnel to play different styles. Now, is it going to be good enough? I don't know, but I feel much better about it this year than I would have felt about it this time last year.
Oh, I agree with that 100%. I don't want to make them out to be, you know, this completely inflexible team anymore, for sure, for sure. But when you get to this level, the margin for error is so low that just because, like, they're late to the game a little bit, right? They're learning these things. They're figuring it out.
Yeah.
It'd be nice if they spent the last 3 years doing this, where this is, you know, such a new thing for them.
Right. Now, if they played, like, Utah and Donovan Mitchell, like, then you're sort of wondering, like, uh-oh, can you really be late? And that's not to say that Utah is better than Phoenix, but I think it's just different, right? The Suns don't have that, like, they don't have either Kevin Durant style big wing. Booker's really good, but he's not that in like a one-on-one pick and roll downhill threat type of guy. He's more of a off movement using his body type of player. That sort of cook you, like, kind of is more like Bradley Beal, which I guess would be bad too, but it's not as bad as Durant, nor do they have that like little pull-up shooter. They have Chris Paul, who's this mid-range master, but he's not, doesn't have the deep range. So I'm not saying that this is like they're gonna 100% solve this, but I think there are worse teams they could have played for this weakness is what I'm saying. I'm not saying that it's like still not a problem, but just I think that there are worse potential. Like if they had played Paul George, I would have been a little worried for them. If they had played Donovan Mitchell, I would have been a little worried for them. If they had played even Jokic and Murray, like if Murray was healthy, that would have been a real challenge. I think this matchup presents challenges, but they're not quite at that level.
Yeah. You've mentioned Bobby Portis enough times. I want to get into my second biggest concern of this series, which is outside of how the Bucks choose to defend. How do the Bucks manage the back end of their rotation? And that's obviously a more pressing concern if they're not getting, you know, a high 30 minutes, low 40 minutes from Giannis, if he's not able to do that. Obviously, Jeff Teague drew a lot of attention in the last series for his minutes. Bobby Portis, I'm with you, could generate some attention for his minutes in this series. Who do you see on the back end of this Bucks rotation as, I won't even go as far as to say that you've got confidence that they can hold up in this matchup, but that you're the least concerned about their ability to hold up in this matchup, that that you'd be trying to get minutes. And who would you have that, hey, even if guys have to play more minutes, you're taking them out of the rotation?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, the Bucks' biggest problem in the series is that once you get past, and this is a problem in the regular season matchups, particularly the one in Milwaukee that was just, I thought was, I don't know if you remember that game from April. I thought that was like maybe the best game of the season, that game. It ended in a kind of shitty way with Devin Booker getting a questionable three-shot foul. But everything before that was great. This was their problem in that matchup in particular. And I think it goes deep into the rotation, but I think it even stretches higher. The Bucks' three best players in that game, Middleton, Holiday, Giannis, had great games. Nobody else really came to play. Pat Connaughton, maybe a little bit. The Suns got not a great game from Devin Booker, a pretty good game from Chris Paul, but they got big games from Ayton and big game from Bridges, and they got big stuff from Cam Johnson and Cam Payne off the bench. They won all the minutes in like sort of the non-starter versus starter or non-closer versus closer minutes. You know, they were terrific in the like, well, we got to take one of our stars out if we're Milwaukee, and we got to play a couple of Bryn Forbes or Connaughton or Portis or whatever. That's where the Suns really thrived in that game, and I think that's where they're going to make their hay in this series too. You know, I have major concerns for Milwaukee depth wise for sure, and I think they've already kind of stretched about as far as you can stretch their best players. You know, it seems hard for me to believe that Holiday or Middleton or Giannis, particularly coming off his injury, can play more. As far as who you play, I mean, it is such a roulette. Like, who, it kind of depends. I do think Pat Connaughton probably deserves more minutes. But if you play him, and you're taking away from like your biggest advantage, which is sort of your size and physicality, particularly on the glass. So maybe Bryn Forbes is a better matchup in this series because you could theoretically hide him on some of the Bridges's or Cam Johnson's or even the Torrey Craig. How ironic. Be nice if the Bucks had Torrey Craig right now. He'd be really useful for them. But the Suns, again, are just so good at manipulating you're picking the spacing and the cutting that they find those guys anyway. Maybe they don't sort of target in a traditional sense on the ball, but they just find a way to expose that weakness. So whether it's off the ball or with help rotations or whatever. So yeah, I think this is the biggest, to me, this is the biggest concern for Milwaukee. I don't have a good answer. I think they sort of have to hope that they get something unexpected from a different guy each night, trying to play around with it. But the Suns are really, really deep for a team this far, and they have a lot of different ways they can manipulate their lineups. So I don't have a great answer. I mean, the one thing is maybe when Ayton is not playing, if you can foul Ayton out, particularly if Ayton has to guard Giannis, which is what he did in the regular season. I don't know if they're going to want to do that in the playoffs. It's going to be an interesting challenge. Maybe if you foul at Ayton and they have to play Sarge more at the five, or then you can kind of play big and crash the offensive glass, but it's not ideal. Like, this is, I think, is a real problem for the Bucks.
Yeah, I think Ayton can handle that matchup. I think Ayton is very underrated and very good at guarding some of those better forwards. He's improved. I think his biggest improvement this year has been being that rim protector, that help defender, more of a traditional center defender. Mm-hmm. I think going back to last year, he was really good at handling Giannis.
Those types of matchups. I agree too. It's just a question of foul trouble. Like, do you want right. hit? Like, how badly do you need him to play? And if you can, you get away with his fewer minutes. Now, it might be a little bit better because at least you have like Jay Crowder and Torrey Craig to kind of bug Giannis, and you might not have as much of a rebounding deficiency without Ayton. But yeah, I mean, that's as far as like his capability of guarding Giannis, I think it's there. I think it's just a question of, can you afford, because he will pick up fouls if he's guarding Giannis. Like, there's no question about that.
For sure, which is a credit to Giannis, by the way. The way Giannis has been shooting free throws, he has not been reluctant to go draw those fouls anyway.
Absolutely.
It helps the team. It changes the strategy. It'd be helpful, of course, if he made the free throws, but it's not just about the free throws. The foul trouble matters too. Looking higher up in the Bucks rotation, I want to get into Eastern Conference Finals MVP. Giannis played four games, played very well. Chris Middleton was a little up and down. Similar with Drew Holiday. Humor me for a second. Who do you think deserves Eastern Conference Finals? Maybe this one's slightly easier than Western Conference Finals because it's not quite as wide open. I'm still not sure. It's not an easy choice. And so, two-part question. Who do you think should win Eastern Conference Finals MVP? And also, what did you take from those Bucks, let's say, Team USA players, not the Giannis superstars, but Chris Middleton, the Drew Holiday? Even you can throw Brooke Lopez in there. How much do you think the Bucks can compete with those guys? If Giannis is out, if Giannis is hobbled, if you're not getting 100% Giannis, can the Bucks still make this a series?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, I do think so. It's interesting. It sounds like you think the Suns are the heavy favorites in this series.
I do. Do you disagree?
I think they are the slight favorites. I think this will be actually be a pretty close series.
I want to say I think they're moderate favorites, right? Like, I wouldn't be surprised one bit if the Bucks win.
Like,
but I'm picking the Suns.
On like a 100% scale, like how confident? Like, I would say it's maybe 60-40 Suns or a little bit less.
Yeah, I've got like 65-35 or so. We're not that far off.
Okay, all right.
Like it sounds like you're on the high end of slight favorite, and I'm on the low end of moderate favorite.
Fair enough. Okay. I think they can. Yeah, I mean, as far as the MVP of the East series, I think it's Drew Holiday. I think Drew Holiday would be my choice. At least, certainly, their success in the last part of this series, I think, was very much tied to Holiday owning his matchup, getting the ball inside, you know, driving down Atlanta's throats, making timely plays on both ends of the floor, particularly when they started to go with that switch scheme. You know, Holiday made some just great plays on the weak side, great pressure there. And I just thought his drive was really key to them. I know Middleton was the guy who had the barrages in games 3 and 6 that sort of put them away, but I thought Holiday was a much more consistent player by the end of the series. I know he had a little bit of a rough time early on. That would have been my MVP pick for that series. As far as this series, I mean, the Holiday CP3 matchup, besides being like super fun and fascinating, like from a like kind of if you just did a freeze frame or like zoomed in on that matchup, there'd be all sorts of funny little tricks and stuff. That may be the most important one in this series, you know, because I've said this before, I think it's going to be a tempo series, right? There's going to be a lot of swings both directions. These teams are prone to stagnation on offense, and both of them run really well off misses. So to me, that's a sign of we're going to have a lot of 10-0 runs going back and forth. And in that setting, the guys who really dictate the pace of the game are the ones who I think are the most important. And that's CP3, and that, especially with Giannis not playing or not 100%, that's Jrue Holiday. So I think Holiday is a really important player. The Middleton thing, they do have a lot of good matchups for Middleton. The one thing the Bucks have sort of subsisted on, particularly with Giannis out in the Atlanta series, in the Milwaukee series, that may be harder to do in this series unless in the minutes Campaign is playing, is they have sort of found the weak matchup and hunted it, particularly when you have two weak defenders on the floor. So like in the Miami series, it just got to a point where like Middleton and Holiday and Giannis to a lesser extent were just like going at Tyler Hero, going at Dragic, going at Robinson, and just relentlessly doing that. In the Atlanta series, particularly by the end, it was doing that to Trae Young, doing that to Danilo Gallinari, just over and over and over again, and just making one of those guys have to guard every single play, being very direct about it. That's not something that you can do as effectively against Phoenix. There is not a pick on you spot. The Clippers kind of found it with Booker, but I think that was more about limiting Booker's offense. You know, maybe the Bucks will probably take a page out of that book and try to target Booker, but Middleton is not as skilled on the ball as Paul George to manipulate that matchup. That's why I think when Campaign plays, maybe there's a better chance. But in general, the Suns are less pick-onable than some of the teams the Bucks have played. So that's a concern if you're Milwaukee. But I do think that they can compete still in this series, but I think the real key will be like if Milwaukee says, okay, we're just going at Devin Booker as much as possible, kind of like what the Clippers did, how well will Booker hold up in that matchup versus a Middleton and Holiday, I think is really key. And I think there's a better shot of him doing that there than I think there was. I think the Clippers offered more challenges than the Bucks do in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, I think Devin Booker has come so far as a defender, particularly on the ball. I think the way to get him is in some off-ball actions. Maybe he can lose some attentiveness there still. I go back and forth on the Bucks offense. Which of these things do you think is more true? The Bucks offense, they can stagnate. They're not getting the best looks. This is not the sophisticated offense you want it to be, for example, the Suns. Or, hey, they still get some good looks, and they're just missing too many open shots. And, this team is it's not the scheme. It's not the strategy. It's that these supposedly good shooters, they're just not reliable enough shooters. I feel like both criticisms have been lobbed at the Bucks throughout the playoffs. I think both of them are somewhat accurate, but they're kind of at odds with each other.
How are they at odds with each other, actually? I'm curious. That's an interesting point. See, to me, I think it's sort of they're intrinsically linked rather than at odds with each other. So I'm kind of curious what you mean by at odds with each other.
Well, so I think a well-designed offense is going to get you good looks. Mm-hmm. And there's this knock on the Bucks that they're getting these good shots, but they just miss them. And there's also a knock on the Bucks that, their offense isn't that well-designed. To me, if you're getting good looks, the offense is well-designed. If you're not making them, that's a execution problem. Those are, two different problems. I think they've had both at times, but that's why I say they're at odds with each other. If you're getting those good looks, if you do believe that they're good looks, then maybe the offensive scheme is a little better than given credit for. Or if they're not good looks, then maybe it's not just a matter of, here the Bucks go again, not being able to knock down good shots.
Okay. Interesting. The way I see it is that it's not a particularly elaborate offense, right? You look at the Suns and they're doing all this stuff with their spacing and their movement and dribble handoffs and the angle of the screen, the angle of the cut, you know, all this sort of I mean, I think Zach Lowe wrote about their pick and roll game and just how diverse it is and how five man it is. I never get that sense of watching Milwaukee. It's much more of a spacing stationary offense, right? You know, it's much more of like, here's where we're going to run the play. Here's where we're going to place our players so that there's less room for you to help. And then we're just going to kind of go from there. There's not a lot of elaborate setup to it. And when that happens, I think you end up with a couple different scenarios. One is that you get the ball where you want it to go. Your players are already in position once you get it there to capitalize on it, whether that's offensive rebounding, which has been a huge strength of theirs, which in part I think is because of that structure. You know, guys are already in the spot they need to be. But also some of those open spot up threes they get. And frankly, like the distribution of their scoring, which is much very heavily weighed towards three players. But if you don't get the ball where you want it to go, then suddenly that lack of movement and the lack of empowering of other players starts to put a lot of pressure on the guys with the ball. And the looks you end up generating are a lot of those like sort of off the dribble jumpers that they have struggled with all postseason. You know, Middleton, Holiday, it just, when they aren't getting to the basket off their like kind of main action, they are taking some shots that are not good shots, that just are not high percentage, but they're intrinsically linked. Because if you're going to run an offense that is so designed on like kind of getting the ball to a guy in a certain spot, and that doesn't generate the best shot, like what is he to do? You know, like, where is he to go? And this is, I think, particularly true when Giannis is not used. When Giannis and Lopez play together, I think one of the reasons that the Bucks were successful is that they sort of put Lopez more at the end of that series without Giannis into more of a Giannis rolling role. And he was effective. You know, he wasn't just standing around kind of watching someone else run a play for a certain spot. He was able to kind of catch the ball on rolls. He was getting the ball in different spots. To me, that's just the nature of the Bucks offense. Like, when it's good because it provides a structure for the ball to go to certain places. And for once the you run your initial set, like, and where you want it to go, after that, if that's in a good spot, the Bucks are well positioned to capitalize. Where they're not as good is if you don't get it to where you want it to go. They don't run a lot of stuff to kind of make sure it gets to where it wants to go, like the Suns do. And that's when they take bad shots. So the answer to me is sort of intrinsically linked. I mean, their shooting woes to me are just a reflection of that. And not necessarily even just the percentage, though it's low. It's also the swings. You know, why do they have so many like 4 of 30 shooting nights, right, in these playoffs? I think a lot of it is because their offense is so, I don't know if prosaic is the right word, but there is not a lot of complexity to it. It is very direct. And because of that, you're kind of at the mercy of your best players in a lot of ways to do what they do. And their best players all have some weaknesses. They're not like Devin Durant. So I think that's a huge part of why you get that.
That makes sense. I want to talk more about the Suns' defense, too. Let me just ask you this. Who do you think has a better defense overall, the Bucks or the Suns?
Boy, that's a good question.
Because I think it's the Bucks. I think if you're just saying overall who has the better defense, it's the Bucks. But I think you hit on something very important when you said there are no weak links in the Suns' defense. And I think maybe we're getting to the point where just consistently deep in the playoffs, it's less important to have the better overall defense, quote unquote. And I know this is somewhat semantic, and maybe you could say the team that has no weak links is truly the better overall defense. Because I think teams are getting so good at picking on weak links that it's more important not to have weak links than to be, you know, look at the Bucks will clean up against the Pistons, the Cavs, you know, whoever in their division by having this really good overall offense that works against most opponents. But you get deep in the playoffs, you get these matchups. I'm starting to think that we need to put even more priority on no weak links.
I think it depends on personnel, which is a boring answer, but a true answer. I would say that the Bucks are more capable of dominant defensive stretches than the Suns are. I think you saw that in the Atlanta series. You know, there was a point where just the Hawks couldn't score. You know, even no matter what type of defense they're playing, they're more capable of that because the Bucks defense is very much built on the premise of we're going to make you shoot slightly inefficient shots. We're just going to shut off the most efficient lane. Whether you're switching, whether you're playing drop, you know, Trae Young is not going to get into the lane easily. Like, we're just going to make him shoot threes. The Suns defense is much more, I think, portable and much more consistent in that it's the same effort each time. It's the same physicality. I think the biggest strength the Suns have is not necessarily the no weak links. It's their ability to play physically without fouling that I think has made their defense work. It is, to me, kind of remarkable just how often and how solid they are with their hands, how they're able to bump with their hips, but then also not foul with their hands. I think it's really hard to walk that balance. The Suns are just more, look, if you make a good move and you score on them, you score on them, right? No matter where it is. They play kind of more solid all the time. The Bucks, because it's built on creating shots at certain places of the floor, like it's like, hey, we're going to let you take that floater. I mean, yeah, we're going to contest it a little harder sometimes than others, but our priority is we're not going to let you go to this zone and we'll live with the rest. The Suns are sort of more like, we're just going to play you the same way no matter what zone you're in. So I think the Suns defense is perhaps more consistent, but the Bucks defense is capable of more highs and lows. And in a playoff series, it kind of depends. I mean, sometimes you want those stretches that are highs and lows, but I think where the Bucks have faltered sometimes is like, well, if you're giving up the shots, I mean, you certainly saw this in game one in the Atlanta series, in game three as well. If you're giving up shots and they're making them, right, that is where it becomes a problem. You're playing a long game in a series that doesn't have a long game, right? Like if you played basketball like 100 times, if there were like 101 game series, like the Bucks strategy would be much better, but they're 7-game series, right? So there is like the sample is smaller. But I think that's sort of the best way I'd describe that, which is better, I think, kind of depends. I don't think there should ever be a hard and fast rule that like this is better or worse in the playoffs. I think that's where we run into trouble with analyzing the game, because this game constantly changes. It hinges on a couple made shots here, a couple made shots there, you know, so many factors. But I do think that Phoenix's defense is more consistent than Milwaukee's. Milwaukee's is perhaps capable of higher highs and lower lows.
Yeah, I guess I would just say that the way the Bucks play in a deep playoff run, you're probably going to run into a team that can make shots from those tough areas, right? Like you're facing higher skilled teams, better offensive teams generally, just as you go deeper, and eventually a team will make those shots, right?
So why hasn't it happened this year?
Maybe it's about to. And I would say to a degree it happened against the Nets, right? Huge credit for the Bucks winning that series, but they had problems with that specific element of the series at times. They had, like you said, problems against the Hawks at times.
Well, that's the thing, though. It's at times. Like, the Bucks right. play a long game, well, right? Sure, but that's like, the thing. But that's sort of the thing, though. Like, sometimes the long game, if you play the long game, you don't have enough time to play a long game in the playoffs, which is your point, right? You know, sometimes, especially against good teams, like, it's hard to expect Kevin Durant to like have four bad games no matter what defense you play.
It's not just Kevin Durant though, right? Like I don't want to get too deep into this, but like there was you know, injury to James Harden, injury to Kyrie Irving. I don't think the Hawks are as strong as the typical team in the conference finals, right?
Credit I agree to them, with that, but then
credit to them for getting there.
But why is that also not true of Phoenix, who had to play a Lakers team that was battered, a Suns team that didn't have, or Nuggets team that didn't have Jamal Murray, and a Clippers team that didn't have Kawhi Leonard?
I think it is true of them too, right? So that's the argument in favor of how the Bucks play, is that some years maybe you can get away with it. Although, look, to win a championship, you got to have a fourth series, and I think this is going to be their strongest test yet. I think it's going to be the strongest test yet for both teams.
Yeah, I agree with that. Although the Lakers before Anthony Davis got hurt are quite a test.
Yes, before he got hurt.
Yeah.
You know what? It's possible too. Even if the Lakers have the same health, if the order of the series were different for the Suns, if the Lakers, you know, the Suns are really, really good. And so if the Lakers even hobbled, got by different teams and different matchups and faced the Suns, let's just say the Suns opened with the Nuggets somehow and stomped them or even faced them in the second round and ended up playing the Lakers in the conference finals, I think people would be questioning the Suns' road less, even with the same Lakers team in that same condition.
Right. Also, you know, to be fair to the Suns, of course, Chris Paul was not himself in that series either. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is a weird year. I just think that a lot of the rules of postseason that we would apply to previous years just don't really apply this year for a number of reasons. One being the injuries. One being just, in general, like, how do we know how good these teams are? Because of they're coming off a 72-game season that had so many COVID protocols and absences and just the density of games. Like, the Suns having a better record, like, may or may not mean what it used to mean, right? We don't really know the quality. We don't have as much sample to know the quality of these teams in the first place. And then the other reason is I just think because of that, these teams are, there's more variability in these teams' performances in general. You know, there's more challenging matchups, more challenging things that we don't really have a good handle on. And because of that, I just don't think that a lot of the rules necessarily apply as ironcladly as they usually do, you know? And then, like, this winner, does it, if the Bucks won, does it mean that, like, you can win playing big? I mean, maybe, but I think it just more means that, like, the Bucks found a way. As I often like to say, you win first and then you make up the rules for how you won later. Right? That's sort of how these things really work. So I don't know. I think it's fascinating to watch play out because I think the league could really use it. But I think it's also, we have to acknowledge that, like, there's elements of our analysis that are dependent on past results with teams that just don't at all resemble past teams that we've seen. You know, these are two very different types of teams. So I don't know if the old rule about, you know, maybe it still applies, the old rule about adaptability in the playoffs being the most important thing. You know, maybe it's better to have a one punch. You know, maybe, you know, if you play this postseason in a lot of different ways, like, different teams probably win. I think there's just a lot of different things going on. So I'm not ready to concede that any rule is actually going to be a rule this time around in terms of how these playoffs are usually decided. I think it will be more about the specific matchup considerations than anything grander in this series.
I'm looking forward to your book on the evolution of the NBA, and I have a question on that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, this year, you're absolutely right. This year is crazy. There's so much to analyze. I kind of think that there is a bigger difference between what wins in the regular season and what wins in the playoffs than ever. I thought that before COVID disrupted everything, and you know, it's probably more truth to it now. This is an outlier. I don't want to just focus on these 2 years, but do you think overall in the game, as we get back to normal, that there's a bigger difference between what wins in the playoffs and what wins in the regular season than there used to be?
I think the answer is yes, although perhaps not for the reasons you think. I think the main reason is just people are treating the regular season differently now, right? You know, there's more rest, there's less practice, there's more of an awareness that these 82 games, like, is just the prelude, right? You're not playing every game like it's your last in the same way. And so naturally, if you're going to sort of hold your cards in reserve or rest your stars or whatever during the regular season, what happens in the playoffs is going to look a lot different, because 62-20 in the regular season in 2020 doesn't mean the same thing as 62-20 in 1990. That's just, like, the biggest reason why there's a larger variability. I think another reason is the variability in shooting, obviously. I mean, taking more threes, playing in more space, you're prone to different swings that you weren't in the past. So I think that's a huge factor. One other factor is that this is independent of the style of play. We just know more about players and teams now. It's just easier to build a scouting report. You know, we can go, I mean, shit. The fact that someone like me can, like, kind of talk about this, you know, is a sign that, like, I didn't have the footage to learn or the foot of the stuff to know about in 1990 because the internet wasn't there. So there's just, I think there's more of a micro scouting element than there ever was back in the 90s. I think also the illegal defense rule going away, opening up so many more different ways to defend, which in turn opened up so many different ways to play offense, has made it so there's, you know, everybody says there's no stylistic diversity in this league. I think that claim is like totally absurd.
Me too.
Like, not, it's like actually the opposite. I think there's not a, I think that they, every team plays so differently. I know like every team shoots threes and the outcomes are the same, but I think like every team plays so differently and there's so many, I mean, it just seems logical to me, right? If you basically say the court now is 35 by whatever the width is, rather than 25 or 20 or whatever, if you just spread the court out, there's going to be more places you can attack. Like, that's like, you basically double the court. So like, obviously there are going to be more ways you can score. You know, to me, that just seems obvious. Like, you can set screens at many different places. You can dribble at many different places. Like, so obviously it's all different how you get your shots. So I think because of that, there are more just potential avenues to exploit. The game is like moves a lot more. And when it does, that just means more places you can kind of find advantages or disadvantages, and more complexity there. So that, all of that obviously rewards a setting where you're able to focus on one team. You have days off between games. You're able to kind of practice and lock in, as opposed to the A2 games where when you combine the load management and the sports science side of it, you're just not really preparing as much for every game. Like, you're working much more on perfecting what you do. And it's always been true that in the playoffs, you know, it's different being able to play one team than being able to play 29 teams. That was true in 1991. That was true today. Playoff basketball has always been different in that regard, like in an underrated way. But I do think that because of all those other factors, the gap is larger. But I don't know if it's necessarily all just because of how the game is played. I just think there's a lot more that goes into it. And frankly, the best way for the NBA to fix that is to shorten the season, which we've talked about a zillion times. You know, the jig, I think, is up on 82 games as like a thing you can do all out anymore. You know, we fooled ourselves into thinking we could do that back in the day. The game was played on a much more condensed court, so there's less running around. Now the game is played all spaced out and spread out. You can't, like, the body can't take that. So teams know that. And so they don't take the regular season as seriously. And so the only solution to me then to that is you can't play that many games. But I don't think that's ever going to happen. So I suspect that the gap will widen.
Oh, yeah. I'm definitely with you on that. The number one reason is because of health and how teams are managed that. I also wonder, like you said, about the sophistication of scouting. If we're going to get to a point where teams do more to prepare for individual games of the 82, if they can put that on their players, I don't know. Like, that's not really exactly how it works. Obviously, there's some game-specific game planning, but so much of it is the regular season is moving fast, and you just kind of do what you do and mostly keep it moving. I do want to get back to the finals real quick before we finish. Mm-hmm. I know this might be your least favorite question. Can I pin you down on a prediction?
A lot depends on Giannis, his health, for sure.
So it sounds like you're saying, no, I cannot pin you down, but give me your.
I don't like getting pinned down on predictions because then I never learn. If I'm wrong, I never learn anything. I just sort of anchor myself to what my prediction was. And I like to try to keep it open. I think the Suns are, I would lean the Suns with or without Giannis. I think it will be a longer series with him, a closer series, a shorter series, maybe if he doesn't come back. But I think the Suns would be my favorites. I think I said before, 60-40 confidence. Whether that translates into number of games, I don't know, six. You know, I tend to think also too, like, what's the point differential of the series more so than anything? Because, you know, you can have six-game series where, like, all the four wins are blowouts and the two wins are really close. But I think the Suns should be the favorites. I like the Suns' chances a little bit more. I thought, actually, the regular season was very instructive for these teams. Usually this season, it's like, well, we can't evaluate that matchup because, you know, sorry, my daughter's in here. Do you want to talk on the podcast? No?
Bring her on. Absolutely.
No, she just ran away. She can come in. It's okay. No, I'm just kidding. I think Suns, if I had to like pin it down, I guess Suns and six is my default prediction. I think the Suns will win, but here's what I'll predict this. I think more people are going to be enjoy this series, are going to come into this series being like, ah, I'm not that excited about it. And by the end of the series, they're going to think, oh, this is actually was really good. I think these two teams match up really well. And interestingly, if Giannis was healthy, I think it'd be a great series. If you're on the fence about enjoying this matchup because there's no like marquee names or different people, this is actually a matchup I was like really hoping we'd get based on the regular season. Like, obviously, I wanted Lakers Nets first and foremost, but this was pretty close to it after the fact. Like, I think these teams match up really well. There's a lot of interesting schematic and stuff that's going on. I think the narrative line is great for CP3 and Giannis. I think they're both sort of easy to root for once you forget about CP3's flopping. I think they're both the teams I think are really easy to root for, particularly the Suns. I just love the way they built this team. I love Monty Williams. I love how they play the game together, their toughness. But the one thing I will be very clear about as a prediction is I think this will be a very good series that if you're willing to open your mind and come in with that, will convert you to being a fan of this sport and this style. Like, I think this series will be, to use the words of Jake Paul from Jake from State Farm. Is he Jake Paul or is he just Jake?
He's just Jake.
Jake. Surprisingly Jake great.
Paul's a different guy.
Surprisingly great. I think this series will be surprisingly great.
I'm with you on that. It's very wise, your idea about predictions and how you view it. I'm not as wise as you. I'm just Suns and six. I think that's kind of me bridging the gap between, is Giannis going to play? Is he not going to play? How is he going to play? Even if he plays, it could be Suns and six. If he plays, you know, 100%, it could be right. Suns and six.
Let's say he's like fully healthy and he hadn't suffered that injury. Like, would you still pick the Suns?
You're not going to pin me down because I'm with you. This could be a great series. I've also been looking forward to this series. If Giannis is 100%, then I feel really good about, I have no idea. And that's so fun.
Yeah. I still think the Suns have the edge because ultimately they have more ways to guard Milwaukee's best players and they have a deeper roster. So I still think the Suns have the edge, but it would definitely be a closer series for sure.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Is there anything about this series that we haven't talked about that you think is important to how this goes?
Again, I think it's a tempo series. We sort of talked a little bit about it, and that's sort of a boring answer. But one of the things that people should understand about this series, particularly as they see these scores, I think there are going to be a lot of swings in this series, a lot of 20-point leads that go away, a lot of blowouts and counter-blowout type of things maybe, because both of these teams are prone to stagnation on offense. I think that's both of their biggest weaknesses outside of maybe the Bucks' depth. They're prone to their offenses sort of having these stuck-in-mud situations for different reasons, but both prone to it. But both of these teams' biggest strength is what they do off misses, right? They're running games, whether it's Giannis kind of coming at you in transition or the Suns with their just sort of great. The Lakers did this really well last year where it's like you play a half court set off the miss, but in the full court and like Mikal Bridges is running and Ayton's running and CP3's manipulation of matchups. These teams are great teams off misses and in the run of play when they're defense and they have good defenses. So I think there will be a lot of stretches where one team looks like they can't do anything offensively and the other team's scoring at will on them. And then it will flip back the other way because neither of these teams, I think, are elite offensive juggernauts for different, entirely different reasons. Milwaukee, because it's not too sophisticated. You know, it seems like it's fairly easy to sort of scheme against. And Phoenix, because like they just don't have as many guys that can make plays. You know, that's those are their Achilles heels. So that would be my prediction. There's going to be a lot of like sort of Bucks get off to a fast start, Suns erase the deficit in 2 minutes, vice versa stuff going on. So I think there'll be a lot of swings and people sort of say like, is this the NBA? Like what, these leads now don't mean anything, all the 3-point shot. And you know, this feels weird. It's not about that. It's about their defense to offense transition that both of these teams are really good at. That I think will cause that. So that's a nice way of saying don't check away if it's a 20-point game.
I think finally we have something we disagree on. Like, our big disagreement was, oh, you think the Suns are 60% to win? I think they're 65. I think you're underrating the Suns' offense a little bit. I mean, yeah, they're not perfect, but I think in some ways it benefits them that they, you know, they've got, you say only two, which is, it's only two, but it's Chris Paul and Devin Booker.
No,
they're so good at it.
Yeah.
And there's a clarity that comes with it, right?
Oh, yeah. No, in general, I think this is like a 80% good, 20% bad scenario for both of these teams. Like, you can't disentangle what's good about your offense from what's bad. I just think that the 20% of what's bad will play out a lot in this series because they're playing their two great defenses too. That's all I'm saying. Like, yeah. I mean, the structure that the Suns have, if they didn't have that structure, they wouldn't do anything. You know, but sometimes your best quality is your worst. I think a lot of times your best quality can be your worst quality. And, you know, I think more the point is that, like, their offenses are both prone to looking amazing and terrible. Right. There's not like a consistency to, like, Brooklyn consistently. Yeah. Okay. Sometimes they shoot and miss some threes, but consistently they get great looks. It looks great. These teams, like, sometimes it can look really grimy and sometimes it can look great. You get some 84-80 games and you get some, what was the final score of game six? 130 to 113, you know, in the Suns Clippers series. That's more what I mean. So no disagreements.
Well, no, I think we do. We almost avoided it, but I don't think the Suns offense is going to look terrible. I don't think they're going to have
ever.
I mean, the Bucks defense is so good. I think we're going to get to a point where if the Suns offense is struggling, it's going to be clear it's because the Bucks defense is doing well. I don't think the Suns, like, sometimes the Bucks offense can just look real junky, and it's regardless of the defense. I don't think the Suns are going to hit that point. I think if their offense is stumbling, I think we're going to say, hey, that's because of the Bucks defense.
Okay, so game four when they scored 84 points, or game three when they had their game, that was the Clippers' defense, not more so than the Suns' offense? I'm asking you honestly. I'm not trying to argue.
I think a lot of it was the Clippers' defense. I also think, I guess I'm putting this more on rust with Chris Paul. Maybe that's wrong, right?
I see what you're saying. Okay.
If it wasn't rust, then I agree with you, but I'm putting it on rust because I think there was just so many times where he was so good. Campaign has reached a level where, you know, obviously he's not Chris Paul, he's not Devin Booker, but you're not going to have as big a drop off when he comes in. Like, you know,
no, that's a good point.
For the second units, I just have more faith in the when the Suns' offense hits its lower level, whatever that is. I think that's going to be higher than you do.
Yeah, I mean, you might be right. I mean, you're right about campaign. I mean, going into the playoffs, I said this and not during the season. This was my biggest concern with Phoenix, is that they didn't have a third guy to kind of create offense. I thought they missed a chance at the deadline to get someone like an Evan Fournier or an Eric Gordon. I think that guy would have really helped them. But it turns out that campaign became that guy. And he played well all season, but he stepped it up really since that late season Lakers game, I think, that they lost, where he was sort of the key to their immediate comeback. So now that they have him, I think that has helped really solve that problem. So they miss him badly in, what was the game he missed? Or did he play all the Clippers games and just went out in game three? I think he
missed the next one, if I remember correct.
They missed, whenever he didn't play, they missed him pretty big, badly. So I do, you know, you are, that is true. And generally Payne will play in favorable lineups for him because the Bucks depth is not great. So that's true. Okay.
Or no, he didn't miss the next one. It was just, he went out early. Fine. So we agree on everything. It's going to be a fun series. I'm looking forward to it. I know you're looking forward to it.
Yeah.
You can follow Mike on Twitter at Mike Prada NBA. I'm on Twitter at Dan Feldman NBA. Mike, thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.